Nevertheless, I am unable to concur in the conclusions of the committee. One, he said, near the conclusion of the deliberations, statement on historical background was offered by the chairman. He dissented from that statement.
Was this Ethel Burt Warfield?
I believe so. Yes, it was Ethelbert D. Warfield.
Yeah, he was president. He had been president of Lafayette College until the moderates got control of it. Then he became president of this women's college in Southern
Wilson.
Wilson. Yeah.
Well, he basically disagreed with the historical summary, which he felt repeats in a briefer form the severe arraignment of the seminary contained in the report to the previous assembly.
Yeah.
And he felt that all the members of both boards should be on the new board. By doing so, all injustices might seem to be avoided. Most of his objections seem to go with regard to the structure, relate to this structure. And one thing he said, the proposed plan subordinates the learned and devoted men who constitute the faculty to an administrative system embodied in presidential authority, and would seem to deprive the faculty and the professors of which it is composed of the independence of thought and speech and so on. He does say, in my judgment, the root and ground of the difficulties are embodied in personalities, and so far as they are not embodied in personalities, they are embodied in the lack of tolerance, which we so strongly claim for ourselves. Undue sensitiveness under criticism, as well as too great liberty of utterance, have more to do with the troubles of Princeton Seminary than the form of government. And he just wanted a postponement of this new structure for the seminary until the incorporators are named and their election by the proposed new board assured, and there's been time for the board to, you know, take up its task. I guess what I'm concerned about is why, with three members coming from the board of directors, and 11 members total, and there were George Luckock, Walter Whalen, those two, and Richard Ernst, and Bradley, they were all on the Committee of Five. Thompson was too. To them was all added Cheeseman A. Herrick, Edward J. Fox, M. Lynn Bruce, John S. McDowell, or Henry S. Brown and John McDowell. Do you know any of those names? Okay. Why was Warfield the only one to submit a minority report, and why didn't his report focus more on the theological differences than on the structural and personality?
He was a pretty old man, and a fine gentleman, and you put a man like that in a committee of people, all of whom are agreed differently than you are in their viewpoint, but they can be very gracious and friendly and ask you what you think about this and that. And you turn in a report and you want to, you don't like what they're doing, you don't agree with it, but you're the only one alone, you don't feel like standing up and making a big fight, big fuss. That's one reason why evil has taken over institution after institution, because people think it's more important to be gracious than it is to stand for truth.
Among Dr. Machen,
I can give you a terrible illustration of that. I told you how I met Dr. McCartney in 1927, and we walked up in the mountains together in Arizona. And as we walked, we had a good part of 2 days walking, and we discussed all kinds of things. And he told me there was a man in Los, in Pasadena, the Presbyterian Church of Pasadena had a pastor, Dr. Freeman, who was a graduate of Princeton Seminary and a thoroughgoing modernist, but a beautiful Scotch brogue he had. And he was very much beloved by people who liked to go to church and hear something that made you feel good, and you kind of enjoy it. But he, as far as I know, he had no belief in any what I would call Christian doctrines. But there were several hundred people from Pasadena used to drive over to Hollywood every Sunday to hear Dr. McLennan in the Hollywood Presbyterian Church, which was followed the gospel at that time. And this is background. Now, there was a wealthy woman there in Pasadena who was very upset that people would have to go clear over to Hollywood if they wanted a Presbyterian church that stood for the gospel. And she was, I think she was at least a millionaire. And there was a church, a Presbyterian church, a few miles distant from the Pasadena Presbyterian Church, First Presbyterian Church of Pasadena, which was called the Lake Avenue Presbyterian Church. And the minister was leaving there, and this woman was ready to give them a lot of money.
It wasn't the Lake Avenue Congregational Church. Okay, because that's where Fuller Seminary was.
Yeah, I know a lot about that.
Okay.
In fact, it was a distant cousin of mine who was pastor about it.
Aha.
But this was the Lake Avenue Presbyterian Church, which she was ready to give a lot of money to build a new building for them and fix things up very fine for a real center of Christianity there. And somebody recommended a certain minister to her. And she wrote McCartney and asked him if this man would be a real Christian leader for the church to take a stand for the gospel. And McCartney told me about it. And he said, well, he said that, you see, McCartney had three brothers. Two of them were strongly on the modernist side. I don't know whether they were modernists, but at least they fought that way all the time. I told you, didn't I, how one of them spoke of McCartney after McCartney brought in a minority report where McCartney had moved people by his stand for the gospel, and his brother got up and said, "Fathers and brethren and brother Clarence," he says, "Clarence is all right. Only trouble with him is he isn't married." And so he kind of feels kind of sour about life. Went ahead and talked that way, and then ended up with telling how he and his brothers, boys, used to kneel at their mother's knee, and their mother would, and he says they would pray, and I forget what was he said. One of them saw, Clarence saw the fountain filled with blood, and I saw the rock, this was. They're entirely different from the rock. See, utterly different. So we have different views, different approaches. But he says, we can deal together there, we can all be together in Mother Church. Even. Our views are different. And he completely destroyed the effect of Clarence's fine talk for the gospel that he had just given as a minority report on one of those committees. But now when Clarence McCartney made a wonderful stand for the truth, and he accomplished a lot. But when I walked down with him and he told me how this woman had written him, and I forget the name of the man, he says, you know, he was a close friend of my brother's and he used to be in our house a lot. He says, how could I write and criticize him? He says, I wrote and told her that he was a nice fellow. And she gave her money, and they got this man as pastor. and they were going to make a great Christian center in Pasadena, and soon the people became disillusioned. They weren't getting any sermons that really stood for the gospel at all, and they gradually drifted away, and all their money was wasted. And this man wrote a letter, I heard a few years later, to a friend and says, find me a church somewhere. I've got to get out of this place. It's hopeless.
Huh.
And if McCartney, with his great stand for the gospel, wasn't ready to speak up against a friend of his brother's in a situation like that, and all that money was wasted. Oh, I thought, he's a great fellow, but it just shows you how these people will not speak up.
Well, did Dr. Machen and his friends feel that the composition of this committee of 11 was stacked against them?
I don't know.
You had moved from there,
yeah,
then, there by then.
It. But I can assure you that it was, because that's the way they were doing things.
Well,
they were doing things that way. They were gracious gentlemen, but they didn't believe in any of these old-fashioned, foolish ideas. But we had a fine organization here, and as the president of Princeton not long ago, this is 20 years ago, he gave a talk here that I asked Posset to go to the meeting, and he reported, and the talk was on the developing church, the changing church, where it's all going into new truth, and we don't hold to any old-fashioned ideas. We don't believe the earth is flat any longer. Why should we hold it to these ideas?
Now, it is now 4:15 p.m. Thursday, July 20th, 1989. We're in the library office at Biblical Seminary, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, interviewing Dr. Alan A. McCrae. And Dr. McCrae, we're continuing on with your years at Princeton. We've been talking about when you met certain people there. You mentioned Paul Woolley, longtime professor at Westminster, who probably would be surprised if you did not recall knowing him before 1929, but you can't recall him until after you had returned from Berlin. And we were talking about some of these other people, Charles Woodbridge, Cornelius Van Til, Carl McIntyre, and also you wanted to say more about Dr. Letcher's son and about Dr. Voss and so on. So let's take it up wherever you'd like.
Well, let's first mention Mrs. Voss. Mrs. Voss told me one day that she was writing a storybook for children, a Bible storybook, and she read me a selection from it, and it impressed me as very, very well-written. It was a way to appeal to children, but it brought out Christian truths in a remarkable way. And I heard later on that the income from the book was giving quite a good income to her children, four children, I guess, after her death. And I think just yesterday I noticed in an Erdman's catalog, I believe, that there still are family. So it went very well, and I like it better than any of the other children's Bible stories.
Do you recall the title?
No, I don't. But it's Mrs. Voss. It's a book of the story of the Bible for children. I don't remember the
I know.
Title.
I think I know the one. Yeah,
yes.
I didn't make the connection that she was his wife.
Yes. It's very, very excellent. I thought I ought to mention that.
If only he could have written as well as she.
Oh, yes. he was once very proud that he got a Dutch book printed in California, a book of Dutch poetry, I think, that he had written, and he said there wasn't a typographical error in it. But the thing was, the printer didn't know any Dutch, so he just had to copy letter by letter, whereas when you know a language, you're bound to make typographical errors.
Huh.
But he was much impressed with that.
Huh.
Once after he gave a sermon in chapel, I went up and told him I thought there was very fine. I wish he would have it published. Oh, he says it's already published in his book, Grace and Glory, book of sermons that he had given. Well, now, if you'd be interested in just this word about that, my first year at Princeton, they made an announcement where, I forget what, I guess it was in the Friars Club probably, that at the Second Presbyterian Church, they would like somebody to teach a teacher training class. And I offered to do it. And the class, which didn't last a long time, included the son of Dr. Letcher and the son of Dr. Voss. And the two of them have gone on to very interesting careers afterwards. The son of Dr. Voss became a missionary in Manchuria and did a tremendous work there. And then he came back to this country and he edited a magazine called The Blue Banner for a long time. And I have been told by people from Geneva College that the college had slipped rather badly from its Christian moorings, and that it's one of the few cases where a Christian college has come back after slipping quite a bit, and that it was Voss who was one of the big factors in bringing it back. And then the other one, Lefferts Letcher, he was in the class and he became very enthused, and he was particularly enthused with what I said about the year I'd spent at the Bible Institute of Los Angeles. And the next I heard, he was going out there. And his family was very much upset about it. But in spite of their urging him he should go to seminary, instead he went out. I heard from somebody out there, he was going out on teams, preaching on the street, very enthusiastic. And then the next I heard, I guess he got homesick. He phoned to his family to send him money to come home. And they'd been very much upset at his going, and now they were equally upset at his giving up and coming back. But he came back. Then he took the course in seminary, and he had terrible trouble with his eyes. And in the middle of an examination, his eyes would go bad, and his mother would have to come over and let him dictate the rest of the examination to her. He had awful trouble with his eyes, and I met him a few years later, and asked him how his eyes were, and he said, no, they were fine. He said that he had met somebody who told him to take certain eye exercises to strengthen the eyes, and he had taken them a few days and hadn't done him any particularly good. And then he met them a while later, and they asked him, and he said that, and they said, well, you didn't keep them up long enough. So he began then taking them regularly, and he got entirely over his eye trouble. And as you know, he eventually followed in his father's footsteps and became professor of Old Testament in the seminary and wrote the book on the broadening church, and I guess fell right in line. So it was a rather discouraging thing. The man made such a wonderful start in a way and then went that way. But I thought to make the thing complete, I should tell about these two fellows. The Vosses had three sons. They were Gerhardus, Bernardus, and Johannes. And once, about 20 or 25 years ago, I was speaking at a Bible conference in Harrisburg, and someone came up to me afterwards and spoke, and it was Bernardus, who lived in Harrisburg and worked for the state. And I had some very interesting visits with him and his family. Well, then, Sunday evening, the Friars Club. I think that's worth mentioning, that at the Friars Club, we ordinarily just went there to eat. And it was, I may have mentioned once before, seemed like half the people there were Mac something or other. And there was a very nice fellow called Warren Allen. And if the man presiding would say, Mac, will you say grace? I didn't know which of the four or five Macs he had in mind. And if he'd say Allen, I didn't know whether he meant Warren Allen or me. So
yeah.
It was interestingly confusing. But then
Each summer while I was at Princeton and while I was at Berlin, I went home to California. And I thought it would be worth putting on this a little about the way trains have changed through these years. I remember when I was a boy going with my father to Montana from Michigan. And at that time, the Pullman cars in which we went, they had, how would you describe them now? They have been out, the ones they had then have not been in existence for quite a few years. But they would have, I think, maybe six on each side, maybe 12 or so sections. They were open. They had a long aisle in the middle. And then they had a wide seat, wide enough for two people, and another facing it. And then another back to the face of that one. And up on above there was something hanging up at the top of the car, which could be let down and make a bed above the lower berth, making an upper berth there. And when we first went on, when I was a little boy, that would come down, and then there was a curtain that went this way in front of both of them. And it wasn't a particularly good arrangement yet. There wasn't much privacy in it that way. Then later they put little curtains in the bottom one inside the big curtain. And then after a little, they improved it by putting a curtain on the upper part and another curtain on the lower part. And two people could use a berth, or one person could use a berth. And for many years, they had that system of the trains. I must have traveled maybe 200 or 300 nights in those. Dr. Machen liked them very much. Dr. Machen said if they would only bring in a Pullman car to Princeton at night, let him get into it and carry it around the country and bring it back in the morning, he'd always have a good sleep. Many people, of course, hated them, though. Didn't think they slept on a train. I always slept very well. I always took the upper berth. And the train people put a great deal of careful work into making that mechanism. The expensive part of making the car was this upper berth, the thing that swung down and gave you that sleep on. Eventually, after many years, they began putting windows in the upper berth in a few trains. But before that, the only advantage of the lower berth over the upper that I could see was that you had the window, which if you wanted to put up the curtain, you could see a little at night. If you
and no ladder to climb. Right?
Well, I never climbed the ladder. I just stepped up on the side of the lower berth and pulled myself up. I never used the ladder. But, of course, if you had to use the ladder for the upper, you'd have to go and get the porter. They had a man they called a porter in each car who would provide, he would make up the berths for you and he would do any necessary things. And many of those, they were nearly all black men. And they used to claim that some of them, that they remembered you. If you'd been on the train a year before, they would claim that they could remember you and recognize you. But I never had anyone say he recognized me. And I never remembered faces, so I wouldn't know whether the claim was true or not. But I think the railroads had a very foolish thing, that after spending all that money on the upper berth, because they got more money for the lower berth, and not much more, maybe $1, $1.50 more for the lower berth than for the upper, they encouraged the people to sell the lower berths instead of the upper berths. And the result was that person after person would not take the train unless they could have a lower berth. And the upper berths would often go entirely empty. And I used to find I'd get an upper berth, and someone, they would say, "I get your lower berth. Would you like a lower berth?" The train people would say. Once I was getting on, was it Cincinnati, somewhere out there, I got on the train, and when I went to pick up my ticket, the man, it was an upper berth, the man said, "Oh," he says, "I could get you a lower." "No," I said, "I want an upper." I went to the gate, and the gate man look at my ticket. You say I could get you an upper, a lower. Well, I said, I want an upper. I got to the train, and the man, the porter who met me, I guess the conductor met me first, and he says, I could get you a lower. And I said, no, I want an upper. And then the porter tried to sell me a lower. But you get the feeling kind of a little bit as if they think you're a cheapskate when you just on it. So after a while, I changed my tactic. And when any of the train men would say, I can get you a lower, I'd say, no, I want to sleep well. I want an upper. He'd say, I always take an upper myself. I like it much better. But the upper, you're further away from the wheels. And less disturbed by people walking up and down the aisles. And the train probably rolled a little more up there, but you didn't get the jar from the wheels the same way. So I always felt it was much better. But if the trains had instead tried to show the advantage of the upper, they would have had many a train, many a car go with twice as many people as they did. And it struck me that the railroad management was, while showing wonderful ability in the mechanical planning and all that, they showed very poor judgment in some matters like this one. And that must have been a concerted policy on the part of the railroad management when all those people were. I remember in Dallas, I asked for an upper. And the woman in the downtown office of one of the railroads was phoning to get it. And I heard her say, what, dearie, all he wants is an upper. So she was evidently trying to persuade her to get me to get a lower. Well, after a while, they had those for 30 or 40 years. But then they began getting the, roomettes, a little separate room, which wasn't near as convenient. Another thing about these Pullman trains at that time was that they had I guess you wouldn't call it a smoking room or a dressing room, but there was a large room at the end of the car where the men could go in and smoke if they wanted to. They didn't, many of them go there to smoke, but a great many went in there to chat. And you'd meet most interesting people sometimes in those that were traveling with you. Whereas in the roomette, you're just shut off from everybody, which succeeded them. And eventually, they did away with those. The overnight sleeper was a wonderful arrangement for getting to places, but it got to where people weren't using them much anymore. I took one from down in Pennsylvania over near Chambersburg into Philadelphia one night. And when I got off, I said to the porter, I didn't hear any noise during the night. And he says, you're the only passenger. And they say one time they used to have a train from Philadelphia to New York that would have, many cars on it. With uppers and lowers, all full of business travelers who'd be in Philadelphia day, and they'd take the train instead of going to a hotel. And you'd go to bed at Philadelphia and wake up in New York. But it got to where there's nobody was taking them anymore, so they did away with it.
Amtrak does have a Washington to New York car now, and a Washington to Boston. But all the Philadelphia to New York is daytime, I think.
Is it? Yeah.
Or evening.
And then, you noticed I mentioned the Harvey Huggles.
Yeah.
On the Santa Fe.
Fred Harvey.
Yeah, on the Santa Fe train, they used to, instead of carrying diners for a while, they put up what they call Harvey Huggles. Fred Harvey was the man.
Restaurateur.
Yes, and the train would stop 40 minutes at a place, and people would get off and eat, and then get back on, and then it would stop at the next place. But it got to where there'd be too many people and you'd have to wait and so on. So they started putting on diamond cars again. When in the time of the Depression, the in the 30s, the trains put on special trains that had cheaper accommodations, very good, and cheaper meals too. I think Santa Fe started with, was it the Challenger they called the special train? And then was the Southern Pacific, was it the Scout they put on, or have a guy?
They had the Argonaut and the Sunset Limited was the crack train later. I don't know when that was on, but then there was an Argonaut, was a slow train on that route.
Yes. But now there's little left of the trains. It's a thing of a past age. Oh, by the way, I was going to mention a man named Fokker, F-O-K-K-E-R. He built the planes that the Germans used during World War I. And he was from Holland. He built these planes for the Germans. And then after the war, he came over to America and built a factory to make planes. And I met him once on the train. And then I met someone else who worked for him. And they told me how he preferred the upper above the lower. But everybody seemed to think he'd look like a cheapskate if he used it. So he had to, every week, he had to go back and forth between his factory in Ohio and his head office in New York. And he would buy two tickets and get both the upper and the lower and ride the upper and leave the lower empty. So they couldn't call him a cheapskate for using the upper. I looked him up in the Encyclopedia Britannica today. They had quite an article.
You had observation cars on there.
Yes.
Do you remember the old open end?
Oh, they were wonderful. The observation car had on the end, they had a platform with chairs on. And they would sit there. Of course, it was kind of dirty, but you'd sit there, and it would go over the rails, click, 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 as you went over the rails. And some people used to tell me they could tell how fast they were going by counting the number of rails in a minute. And you'd sit there, and of course, you didn't see what you're coming to. You saw what you were coming from all the time. But it was very interesting. I used to love those observation cars. But they were in the West. All the Western trains had them. In the East, they didn't have many. And Paul Woolley, I mentioned this to once, and I said, it seems in the East, they don't have any observation cars on the day train, just at the night trains. Well, he says, but they look so nice, leaving New York or Philadelphia all lighted up. That's, again, seemed very short-sighted on the part of the real mention. Oh, and there was a time when a man from Texas bought a Northern Railroad, and he noticed that everybody going from New York or Philadelphia to the coast had to change in Chicago. And he put some big ads in and said, a hog can ride from one coast to the other, but you can't. And so the result was that the trains began advertising they would have a car from coast to coast. And I took it once or twice, but you take the car and it would arrive in Chicago in the morning, and then you get off and they carry it out in the out to the 10 miles out, and then they'd bring it in at night and you get on again and they'd take you on. It was really quicker to get two tickets and not use that service. So it was just a fake service. But they advertised it for a while, and I thought it was his advertising. Sunday evening at Friars, they used to have a sing Sunday evening on the steps right after supper. I remember those so well when the students, remember the Friar Club who were in town, would go out there and
which
sing
steps?
On the steps of the eating house toward the H. See,
the Friars Club building itself.
Yeah, the Friars Club building. we would sit out there on the steps.
And what sort of songs?
Hymns. I always used to, once they always sang, had in it four lines. Or I think the second stanza includes something about the children and the sailors in one verse, which always struck me as incongruous. Bless the children, thinking of thee, be with the sailors tossing on the deep blue sea, or something like that. Seemed to me quite
important. What sort of hymns did they sing? And did you ever get any public attention?
No, it was just, there'd be maybe 15 folks there every Sunday night after the meal. And at Princeton, they gave certain prizes for papers on certain classes, and then they had fellowships. And certain departments had fellowships. And Dr. Wilson had the Department of Semitic Philology, and they had a fellowship which alternated with another department. So he'd get it only every other year. And one year came in my Midler year. They had one in church history every year and one in New Testament every year. And one in, Dr. Davis was professor of Old Testament. And Dr. Wilson was professor of Semitic philology and Old Testament criticism. And I asked Dr. Wilson, should I write a paper in order to try to get the fellowship in Old Testament, since you don't have a fellowship next year? And he said, no, he says, don't do that. He says, the Lord will take care of you. He says, don't do that. And I said, well, wouldn't it be safer to write a paper to get this? And, well, he says, no one can serve two masters. He says, you're working with me, you better can just take my courses and work with me and don't bother with that. So I didn't. And Charlie Woodbridge worked for the Old Testament paper and got it. And there's a story there that's a separate subject. But Dr. Wilson said, he says, don't you worry. So fellowship was $600 for a year of study and travel abroad. And came to just about the end of the senior year. And it seems that the president of the American Bible Society wanted to give a fellowship to Dr. Wilson for the carrying on of the work Dr. Alice was doing. But Dr. Wilson persuaded him to give it to me instead. So I got a fellowship of $1,000 a year, while the other fellows got $600. And Everett Harrison heard I'd gotten a fellowship, a special fellowship, they called it, because it was given to Dr. Wilson just that one year. And he announced at the Friars Club that night that I had gotten a fellowship of $600 to go abroad and study. And since it was $1,000, but the other fellows were getting $600 for their fellowships, and I didn't see any need of correcting him. I did get a $600, but I got $1,000.
That extra $400 would have been a very...
In those days, it'd be a lot more than it would be today.
And especially...
Yes.
66% more than the...
than the $400. Yes.
Or
yes,
whatever. My mind's not working too well.
66 and two-thirds percent more than $400. Then 600, right. I went over in July to Germany, and...
this would be July of 27. Now,
yes.
You knew then far enough in advance that the fellowship was coming to make all of your plans?
I didn't have to make any plans. I just... Dr. Will said not to worry.
But I mean, in terms of passport and applying to the university, or did he write a letter and you didn't really need much formality to formal proceeding to go over there.
Didn't need any proceeding. He just walked in like he did at seminary. Walked in and you had to show evidence of your abiturient. In Germany, the gymnasium is the equivalent of American college plus American high school plus 2 years of college. And you had to show that you graduated from a gymnasium. But of course, we don't have gymnasiums. And so I took my MA from Princeton University and showed it to them. I had to leave it and with the university while I was there.
Now, your German was already in good enough shape to...
My German was in... I had had 2.5 years in high school of German. And this was 10 years before I went over. And my German was in such good shape that the day I got there, I went to a class at the university, a class for foreigners at the university, in which Professor Spranger spoke for an hour on present tendencies in education. And I got the word yes and the word of. That's all I got out of the whole hour lecture. Well, I got there in July, and I had until November to work on the language. And I knew a lot more by November. Dr. Alice visited me in Germany, and he said my German was not wunderbar, but wunderlich, which means not wonderful, but ridiculous. But I worked very hard on it. And it was quite different later. Now I better take a look. Maybe I'd say a word about the word Princeton when I was there. But I can't think of their names, unfortunately. But one of them went to... that wouldn't have hurt.
Go right ahead.
One of these two students decided to go as... in fact, both of them went as missionaries. But one of them went as a missionary to Siam, and I heard that he showed a lot of initiative in doing things and really proved to be a very fine missionary. But his wife heard some stories about the old history of Siam, and she wrote a book, which they came back and they offered to several publishers, and one said it's just a little Sunday school story, wouldn't be of much interest to people. But eventually they found a publisher who published it, and it became a bestseller. It was called Anna and the King of Siam. And then from it they made a musical called The King and I, which went all over the world, I guess. And the last I saw him, he was going to try to get a position in Washington in foreign affairs or something. So I'm afraid the book gave him too much money to go continue in missionary work.
Who was this?
I don't remember his name, but his wife wrote that book, Anna and the King of Siam.
How about that?
Yeah.
And he was a student at Princeton Seminary?
He graduated when I did, yes.
How about that, in the same class?
Yes. And there was another fellow in the class who went as a missionary to Korea, I believe. And I'm not sure now. He says, go on. Shall I go on? It was quite a seller, and then they made this musical, which became very famous all over the world. This other fellow was a graduate of Wheaton, and one day, toward the end of my senior year, he said to me, I've decided no longer to be a premillennialist. I'm going to become an amillennialist. And I said, why? Well, he says, it says in the Scofield Bible that this verse in Acts 15, that I will build again the tabernacle of David. It says this is the most important verse dispensationally in the New Testament. So he says, this is the verse that premillennialism rests on. And he says, just plain exegesis shows that it doesn't teach premillennialism at all. So he became an amillennialist, and then he became a postmillennialist a week later. is what he told me. And I think he just came back this year, and he's now in the Presbyterian home in Philadelphia. I haven't seen him though since I graduated from seminary. But I wasn't a bit impressed with it because I never thought that was a very important verse for premillennialism at all. I didn't see how it had a great deal to do with it. But later on, I studied the verse, and years later, I wrote an article on it. And it seems to me that actually the verse is about circumcision. And if you don't relate it to premillennialism, it has nothing to do with circumcision. James gave a verse, and then he says, therefore my judgment is so-and-so, and his judgment makes no sense if the verse isn't a premillennial verse. So I wrote an article on it. I think the verse is really a point in favor of premillennialism, but I don't think it's what premillennialism is based upon it, by any means. So I thought it was rather inane of him to give up his belief on that one verse simply because a note in the Bible said this was the most important verse.
Huh.
But, one more thing about Princeton might be of interest. At the end of my second year, somebody came and said, in the Friars Club, somebody dropped in and had a meal with us, and who had just had a year study in Germany on a fellowship. And he gave a talk which was quite interesting. I don't remember much he said, but after my first year in Germany, I dropped in and had a talk, a little talk about my year in Germany. And when I finished, one of the new students came up to me and was much interested, and we talked a little bit. I was staying at Dr. Wilson's house, which was about 3 blocks away, and he walked over to me, with me to the house. He had just been at the seminary, I guess, 3 days at that time. And he walked over.
Now, who was this?
His name was Carl McIntyre.
Aha.
Thought you'd be interested.
Yes.
Yes. That was my first meeting with him.
Well, elaborate. Go on.
Well, there isn't anything more to say about it, I don't think.
He walked over to the house?
To Dr. Wilson's house and left me at the door.
How did he happen to be coming over?
Well, he just heard me speak at the Friar Club. He was a new friar, been a friar for 3 days already. And he heard me speak and come up and talk to me, and then we kept talking and walked over to 3 blocks together.
And what was your impression?
I thought he was a nice young fellow.
What did you talk about, do you recall?
No, I don't.
And then he left you as you went in?
Oh, yes.
When did you see him after that?
The next time was when I began teaching at Westminster Seminary, and he was done the second year student.
Did you recognize him?
Oh, yes. I suppose I did, but, I mean, he might have recalled it to me, but I think I my memory is better than it is now. Well, let's see, as far as Princeton is concerned, Professor Armstrong, you know, Armstrong talked so low you couldn't hear what he said. So 3/4 of students wrote letters, and they studied other subjects, paid no attention. So I had him my last 2 years, so the third year, they assigned seats in all the classes. I went to the person who assigned the seats and said, would you give me a seat in the front in Dr. Armstrong and Dr. Voss's class so I could hear everything they said better? And they said, all right. So I was number one in the roll for the class, 70 students. And then immediately Dr. Stonehouse saw where I was sitting. He was then Ned Stonehouse. He went and asked for a place at the beginning of all classes. So in 2 classes, he had the first seat and I had the second. And in the other classes, he had the first seat and the rest was for all alphabetical. But Dr. Armstrong would tell a joke. He'd look over at us because he knew we were listening to him.
Huh. And there was no student evaluations or
nothing like that.
No attempt to, on his part, to improve.
Oh, he gave the stuff. It was up to you. Take it or leave it. They had a story they used to tell there. They said that one of the professors, somebody went to one of the professors once and said, if you go on this way on some matter, he says, you won't have any students. And the professor said, Princeton Seminary will go on just the same, whether any students or not. That's the story they told.
Huh, really? Why did they tell that? Because of the pedagogical problems?
I don't know.
Somewhat, or just an amusing anecdote?
Amusing anecdote, I guess. There was another story that a professor went in and put up a note on the board and said, Professor so-and-so will not meet his classes this morning. And one of the students came in and he erased the C at the beginning of the last word. And, of course, the students were practically all men then. Maybe all men, I don't know. But it made the last word a little different. So they said the professor came in. He saw how the note had changed. One letter had been erased, so he erased the second letter.
And how is that?
The word was classes, and the student erased the first letter.
I got it.
The professor erased the second letter.
Huh. Oh, unreal. Yeah. I'm really slow today, I guess. I was thinking of the last letter.
That's the trouble with this sort of thing.
Sometimes you get a little different twist on something.
When did
you first meet Ned Stonehouse?
It was my first week at Princeton Seminary. See, they had us, the new students, had dinner one night at each of the classes. I think they divided us up somehow so that at each of the four eating clubs would entertain a fourth of the students each night until they'd entertained all the new students, and then they'd have a vote of the students as to what eating club they wanted to join, and of the eating club what students you wanted to have in your club. And I noticed that a fellow named Ed Stonehouse happened to be in the same group I was in. So he was one of the first I met him.
Hmm. Did you have much contact with him during your years?
I had quite a little. Not a great deal. Dr. Alice once had the two of us down to his house in Philadelphia. But I didn't have a lot of contact. I had some.
Now, Dr. Alice commuted out?
Oh, no. Dr. Ellis had a room in the dorm.
But his house was in Philadelphia, so he'd go home some weekends?
Yeah. He had a nice home in Philadelphia.
Did most of the faculty live close to the seminary there?
Yes, I think they all did.
And you were in the homes then?
Dr. Ellis and Dr. Machen weren't married, so each of them had a room in the dorm. And rest of the faculty, I think, all had houses near. There was a house, the house the Wilsons were in was two or three blocks from the seminary. And this house had been the house of the professor of church history before Lincoln. And they said that the story that I was told was when the professor's funeral, the professor died, and his funeral was held in the morning. And that afternoon, Dr. Stevenson went to his widow and asked her to vacate the house. And Dr. Wilson moved to that house. So it was not far from the seminary. Nice place. The Wilsons often had tea after the last class. They would often ask me to stay with them. Then the family would. As far as Princeton's concerned, we're on actual form. We should not say that. You were speaking about Ned Stonehouse, and I'd been speaking about Dr. Armstrong. And Dr. Armstrong gave a course the last semester I was there in 2 Corinthians, which Ned Stonehouse took. Well, I audited it for the first half of the semester. I simply dropped in. And it was on 2 Corinthians, and at the end of half of the semester, he was still on the words, Paul the Apostle Jesus Christ.
Oh, my.
I personally wondered why he didn't call the course Paul's Apostle instead of exegesis 2 Corinthians. But when I mentioned to Ned, he says, oh, that's real exegesis.
Didn't the students get awfully frustrated at that?
I don't know. I never heard anyone say it.
I thought Dr. Effort was bad at faith, you know, getting through maybe 2 or 3 chapters out of a 14 chapter book, or,
yeah,
you know, whatever, 15 chapters in first book, whatever.
Yeah. But he spent the whole, half the semester was still on that. Well, the next year I went to Germany to study. And I got there in time to spend a lot of time on the language. And also took some good watch.
Oh, may we back up just a moment? What was the graduation? Do you remember anything about the speaker, or do you still have a commencement program or anything?
I don't think I do.
And was that in, where were those held then? Miller Chapel?
Yes. Miller Chapel was where we had our chapels, which always were the same. They would have a professor have the chapel for a week, and then another professor for a week, and so on. And the chapel was only 20 minutes. And they always started with a hymn, and then he'd read a passage from Scripture, and then he'd lead in prayer, and they'd sing it up. So that was always the chapel. But then they had an evening meeting, which was voluntary, at which they often had good speakers from outside.
And you mentioned these hymn sings Sunday evening.
Yeah.
Up, were there any Sunday evening services at Second Presbyterian?
Oh, yes. But I don't remember how often we went.
And the kinds of hymns that were sung, were they from the Presbyterian hymnal?
In the church, but in these hymn sings were the popular gospel songs. Like that one about bless the Savior. Bless the give to little children thoughts of thee. Bless the sailors tossing on the deep blue sea. That's the second verse, I believe.
Now, why Berlin?
Well, many students used to go to Germany and study in different places. And Charlie Woodbridge and Ed Ryan took us each a semester at Berlin and then a semester at Marburg. But when I got over there, I found that other universities in Germany, one would be good in this, another would be good in that, another would be good in that, but Berlin was good in everything. And when it came to Semitics, but I went for the study of Semitics, and they had the best in all the Semitics. So you could get far more there than so I stayed there 2.5 years.
And could you tell us that anecdote about Charlie Woodbridge getting this fellowship? You said that's a story in itself a little bit ago. As to his...
Well, there's a lot about Charlie. I better leave him for a separate section, I think.
Okay, do you want to start next week with him?
There were many interesting things about his life. Well, good.
Okay, why don't I put that down?
Oh, maybe it should be mentioned that when I was at Princeton, there were a lot of what they called the Bookmanites. That was quite a movement there then. Later they called themselves Moral Majority. And later before they called themselves Moral Majority, they called themselves Oxford League. And they were going to convert Hitler at one time.
These were students that were members of this? Or who were the Bookmanites?
They were outsiders and students, but it was a big movement among students. first. I didn't have much direct contact there. The bulk of the students there were dead against it. And it was big in the university, too, but a lot of them in the university was dead. The trouble was when the university students had a big meeting against Buckmanism.
Oh, Buckmanism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What they said was most of it against Christianity rather than against Buckmanism. We didn't agree with the Buckmanites, but we didn't like their attitude either. This man, Buckman, was a chaplain in Penn State University. And he wrote a book on his experience. He asked somebody who was some lost about fellow, he says, can you change so and so? The fellow couldn't, and then he worked out. He said he changed it. And he got quite a movement in which fellows would, they'd have meetings at which they would all confess. Their big thing was confession. And as I say, they moved it to Oxford, and they called it the Oxford movement. And I said they should have called it the Penn State movement. That's where it started. But I think they were well-meaning fellows. It was a deviation from real Christianity.
And nothing to.
It became quite a group, and. I was quite disgusted at that. There was one of their leaders was a great big tall fellow from a very wealthy family who was a great big wonderful athletic Buckman fellow, had gone into Buckmanism and devoted all his energy to it. And Bob Marsden, who was a good friend of mine in the early years at Westminster, went to a meeting somewhere, and Haynes fellow met him there and said, you're going back home to middle, he lived out near Harrisburg. And, oh, he says, yeah, it's a tough thing, I have to go there tonight. Haynes says, why don't you come home with me? So he came home with Haynes, stayed overnight, and his sister and mother were very, they were pleasant to him, but that was all. And they were suspicious of him because he was with their brother, Chas Haynes, who was a strong Buckmanite. And then he left in the morning and missed his train and came back to the house and talked with them, and they found out he was a real Christian. When Dr. and Mrs. Goforth came to the seminary, they talked to Ev Harris and me about going to China, but they got a glimpse of this Haynes fellow. He said, oh, if we could get him to China, that'd be wonderful. We knew about his real character, you know. They didn't.
Haynes, as you said.
Haynes was a family, fine Christian family.
Well, next week, why don't we, Steve will be interviewing you. And if you could begin maybe with Charles Woodbridge, the 1927 to 29 in Berlin, the trip home during that time, that probably would be.
Okay. Is it on? First Sunday in Berlin was a very sad occasion for me. I went to the American Church, and the American Church had a name on the front of it, of a fellow who I'd heard a lot about in Princeton. Seemed like coming home to be where he'd been pastor for the last 3 years. But the week before I got there, he left to come back to America. And they had a young fellow from the Southern Church who was going to be in Berlin a semester, and they were presenting him to be pastor of the church. And he preached and gave a good gospel message. And in front of me were two Presbyterian ministers from Chicago in the audience, and they were whispering to each other, oh, that old-fashioned stuff.
I think somebody you told this story.
Yeah. So that was a sad introduction to Berlin.
Huh.